The Leo Ramirez Show. The best mix of Latin American music, news, sport, and commentary from around the local and international Latin American communities. Saturday, 5 to 6 p.m. at CITR 101.9 FM. El show de Leo Ramirez. La mejor mezcla de música, noticias, deportes y comentarios de la comunidad latinoamericana. Sábado de 5 a 6 de la tarde en el 101.9 FM CITR.
Juicebox is a sexuality education show geared to adult audiences. Listener discretion is advised. Dropped into Juicebox Radio, where sexuality educators quench your search for responsible, progressive sexuality over your lifespan.
I think you've landed in Juicebox Radio 1.9 FM. Or maybe you're one of our podcast listeners, but however you've decided to spend this hour with us, we are glad to have you. And Julia is laughing right now. Her face is quite cutely red.
I don't quite know what to do, Caroline, with that entrance.
I think I shocked you, didn't I?
You don't cease to ever surprise me, my love.
Thank you, I think.
Right. So tonight the topic is going to be controversial enough that we're not going to be inviting you to call in and contribute tonight. We're going to invite you to email us at caroline@juiceboxradio.com or julia@juiceboxradio.com.
Or you can Twitter us if you're on a Juicebox Radio Twitter.
Okay, so tonight, find out the warning signs through the vicious cycle of relationship abuse and violence. And on tonight's Juice Box, we're going to be leading listeners on the darker cycle of abuse and sexual violence, which can often lead to, for a lot of people, addiction and mental ill health. And also learn what key behaviors to watch for in a potentially abusive partner. You may be dating one, and you may have married one. You never know. So we're going to be talking about that.
And in the second half of the show, we're going to be wondering, is there a connection with a violent past or violent tendencies in those who engage in BDSM?
And we need to talk a little bit about what BDSM is, but for those of you who know what it is, that's great. For those who don't, we're going to talk about it later on. So you might just have to stay engaged with the material and stay with us for the show.
I found it really interesting. I was ran into somebody today that during my lunch hour and ran into one of our listeners who asked, what was tonight's show all about? And I told him, and he told me that when he heard about somebody who is sexually violated, he always felt it was the victim's fault for staying in the relationship when it came to sexual violence. And I spent half my lunch hour at the Pacific Center food court arguing about it. And that got me thinking, I wonder how many other people out there secretly wonder, why do people stay in these relationships? How do they get there in the first place? How does this all come about? Mm-hmm. So I thought maybe what we should do is touch on that a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's why the BC Women's Hospital and Health Center, they had a Building Bridges workshop that Caroline and I attended a few weeks ago. And it did sort of spawn, I think, our thinking and perhaps some of your arguments in that conversation with the person who was probably misinformed. And so, again, a good time for us to discuss it. So when we were at this Building Bridges workshop through BC Women's a few weeks ago, there was this really powerful exercise that they had us do that really painted the picture of what could happen to just about anyone who might be in an otherwise stable-looking relationship from the outside, especially. We're just going to walk you through that exercise because I think it really affected both Caroline and I quite a bit. So,
you're a 28-year-old white woman whose husband of 7 years has never hit you, but has started to constantly put you down when no one else is around. Over the years, you've stopped inviting your friends and family over because, although he's very sweet to them, he lets you know for several days afterwards what an inconvenience it was to have them over and makes fun of everything they did or said. He won't let you work. He says it will make him look bad, that people will think that he can't provide for his family. You're thinking seriously about leaving him when you find out you're pregnant. So then you go to prenatal care and to the hospital to give birth. So go over to healthcare.
And so we had to sort of walk across with our group and go over to these different stations, and one of the stations was healthcare. When in the hospital to give birth, you try to talk to someone about your concerns with your relationship, but your husband never leaves your side, and the nurses keep telling you how lucky you are for having such a supportive partner. When you try to talk to one doctor, when you're finally alone, the doctor interrupts you and asks instead about specific symptoms. Within 5 minutes, she tells you she thinks you have postpartum depression. You're referred to a psychiatrist. And then the game, we have to go to the next station, which was to mental health. So go to mental health.
They squeeze you in to see an available psychiatrist briefly. After a few minutes of talking to you, the psychiatrist prescribes Ativan. And what you really want to do is talk to a counselor, but the next available appointment is in 5 weeks. You're sent home. So then we walk and head home.
Your husband is so horrible to you, constantly telling you what a bad job you're doing with the baby and never helping you. You decide to leave your partner. So you pack a small suitcase, mostly with the baby stuff, and go to your sister's.
Family and friends. Your sister calls your mom, and together they convince you to go back home. They feel you're just upset because of the hormones, that the kid needs two parents to raise them, and he's essentially a good guy. So you go home.
And at home, you decide to fill the prescription for Ativan, thinking that maybe the problem is you. However, after your husband throws dinner plates at your head while holding your daughter in his other arm, you decide to leave again. You go to a payphone and call a transition house.
So you go to housing. The transition home is full, and no other spaces available are in your area. None of them can be found. So you go home.
And at home, your neighbor reports you and your husband to the Ministry of Child and Family Development. After overhearing the latest incident where your husband threatened to kill your daughter if you didn't stop aggravating him all the time. So go to the Ministry of Child and Family Development.
At the meeting with the MCFD worker, you feel she treats you as though you're equally as dangerous to the baby as your husband. Even though your neighbor reported that they suspected your husband is abusing you, she creates a joint service plan for you and your husband, requiring both of you to attend parenting classes and anger management classes. So you go home.
And at home, you feel more alone and depressed than ever. So you decide to access a local mental health clinic to see if you can talk to someone. Go to mental health.
When you arrive, the intake worker tells you that the next step is to be assessed, and diagnosed. You are too worried that a diagnosis might be used against you by the MCFD and decide against seeing someone. You decide to go home.
At home, your husband is angrier than ever and constantly harasses you about being a bad mother. He blames you completely for the involvement of the ministry. Even though you think it's unfair, you are desperate not to lose your baby, so you try to enroll in a parenting program.
The program you referred to tells you that while they support families that are until the kids are 3 years old, they can only take women into the program while they're still pregnant. They tell you about another program, but it's on the other side of the city. Your husband no longer lets you drive the car, so it would take you almost 2 hours each way to get there. So you decide to go home.
Well, at home, you begin to keep a bottle of vodka in the laundry room, and within a few months, you're drinking almost a whole 26-ounce bottle each day. After stumbling one day and almost dropping the baby, you realize you need help. You don't care about hurting yourself, but you care very deeply about your daughter. Go to detox.
You can't have your child at detox. You call your husband and beg him to take care of the baby while you're there. He refuses, and he says he'll go for custody of your daughter if you don't come home. So you go home.
When you arrive home, he beats you, while telling you the whole time what a mad mother and a drunk you are. Afterward, you drink a whole bottle of vodka. The next day, your husband reports your alcohol use to the ministry, and your baby is taken into care.
You go to the ministry. You and your husband both get supervised visits twice a week. You're ordered immediately to go into treatment and to complete the parenting and anger management classes. Your husband has no further requirements added to his service plan, even though you disclosed the abuse to the child protection worker. Go to alcohol and drug.
And there you go through an intake process and then learn to assess the women's only group. You have to first do an early recovery group, which is co-ed. You've been put down, pushed around, and controlled by your partner for long enough that you don't want to be around men when you're in such a vulnerable state. Plus, you know that if he ever finds out that there are men in this group, you're going to be in for it. So you have to go home.
At home, you work hard to stay clean and sober for the next month in order to get into a woman-only residential treatment center. You think this might be your chance to kick the booze for good, so you go to the drug and alcohol.
And at the alcohol and drug place, you find out that they won't take you after all, after you've been clean and sober for a month, once they learn that you're taking Ativan, which they inform you is a benzodiazepine. There are no treatment facilities to help people deal with their addictions to benzos. You go home.
At home, you save bits of grocery allowance that he gives you, carefully, stealing some of the change from his pockets when you do laundry, and slowly squirrel away almost $800. You decide that you're going to leave and find a place and get a job. So you go to employment.
And you rent an apartment, and you begin to look for work. But because you haven't worked for the past 9 years, you can only find part-time minimum wage jobs. You also realize that childcare will cost almost as much as you would earn in a month. You decide to bite the bullet and apply for income assistance.
Because your savings came from his earnings, the income assistance worker wants a letter from him saying that he supported you, but no longer will be doing so. You try to talk to him about writing that letter, but know that he isn't going to. He tells you to come home because your rent is overdue and you have absolutely no income and nowhere else to go. You go home.
And at home, he beats you badly and sexually assaults you. You begin to drink again. 6 weeks later, you find out you're pregnant again. You know you will never get your daughter back or keep this one if you don't stop drinking. You decide to go to detox again.
You begin detox, but during your second day there, you get a call saying your mother has been admitted to the hospital because of a heart attack. You decide to leave to go to her, but because of the mandatory attendance rule, you aren't allowed back in detox. So you go home.
At home, you really want to stop using substances and give your kids a good life, but you really feel trapped and unsupported. So that is the end of that particular exercise that Caroline and I went through with a group of others in this Building Bridges workshop at BC Women's Hospital and Healthcare Center. And it was a really profound and powerful. You know, we had to walk all around the room and just getting more and more layers of the complexity of what can happen in abusive relationships that have, you know, all these multiple layers that go on, the different ministries and different aspects that people try to get their lives back together. They often wonder, how did they get there? And we were saying at the beginning of the hour, you know, why do women stay in violent relationships? And we'll also be discussing, why do men batter? But it's interesting. It's easy to kind of blame the victims in violent relationships. And often we hear that people say, if a guy ever did that to me, I'd leave. And it's sort of an assertion that lacks understanding of all these forces at play that Caroline had talked about in this exercise. I mean, where would you go if you had to leave your home tonight with your children? Where would you go? And then what? You know, what choices does a woman have when she's financially dependent on her abuser, or when income support levels mean total poverty for her and her children, which is often the case, especially in a place like Vancouver?
Especially in the downtown east side, where it is a huge community. But even without that community, there's Carisdale, there's different aspects, different pockets in the city where there is many communities within itself, whether it be your church, wherever, whether it's your daughters, your mothers, friends, sisters, cousins. It can be anybody, you know, and I think that's really important. And what choices does a woman have in a community of, say, 500 people when they're leaving an abusive marriage where it may mean leaving the community forever, leaving and disappointing family and friends? Abuse is never the victim's fault, and there's often many psychological issues affecting abused women and their ability to leave an abusive relationship. And self-esteem levels in abused women is often so low that the idea of changing her life may seem truly impossible. And there's so many reasons that exist for people to stay.
Yeah, I think that we were saying,
you know, touched on the financial dependency.
Yeah, like, why do women stay? And I think that, you know, some women lack access to cash or bank accounts or money management skills. And some women, you know, a lot of times any kind of support level, you need to have at least one dependent child. For some women in abusive relationships, they don't have any children. So there's even less opportunity for her to get support. If the control that's been in that violent or abusive relationship has been about money, oftentimes that's a control factor that they don't have an opportunity to manage it, or they don't feel, you know, they haven't been able to save anything. So that's a big reason, a very big reason oftentimes, is financial dependency.
And leaving a place where you grew up, it can be absolutely devastating for the women, their children, and the families. And it's a reality with women living in small communities, pockets of them all throughout the province, even within our city. Children missing school in this case, and they lose connection sometimes with their friends.
Another reason why a lot of women stay in abusive relationships is because leaving a violent relationship could and often does actually escalate the violence if the abuser finds her. Separation panics the abuser, and it often embarrasses the abuser. So the community has found out what's going on in the process, and they freak out. So what few abusers and abused people realize is that the community is already often aware of the violence that's going on. So if this is a concept that you're afraid is going to sort of blow open, oftentimes people already know that it's happening to you.
And one of the other reasons is many women are socialized to believe that they're responsible for making their marriage work. And failure to maintain their marriage equals failure as a woman to a lot of women.
And, yeah, I mean, even, yeah, lesbian relationships as well, I think. And for all people, I think that we feel we fight for a relationship, to even if it's not working or if it is abusive or violent. So I think that also, you know, many women rationalize their abuser's behavior by blaming the stress in the life or the alcohol use or problems at work or unemployment or other factors. And there's a lot of rationalization that goes on for both. And we'll talk a little bit more about the warning behaviors that perpetrators will do. But yeah, a lot of this rationalization happens because of the fears that Caroline and I are talking about.
And one thing I did want to bring back is you kind of touched on it a little bit about people staying in relationships for a long time. And I think sometimes that's because there's a lot of hope and love. And I think those really keep women in violent relationships.
I've seen it happen lots of times with different people that I normally what is considered to be quite intelligent, thoughtful people, and mm-hmm. they stay in abusive relationships because there is love in that part of the in the normal behavior cycle part of abuse. When the perpetrator is, you know, rationalizing their behavior, they're going into a normal behavior cycle, or they're in the honeymoon phase of the cycle mm-hmm. of abuse and violence. That there is this sort of love, and that the perpetrator has gotten very good at being a real sweetheart, and like, you know, people around the relationship think that he's such a great guy or something like that, and you know, he himself rationalizing behavior, and then the aggravation starts and things like that. And in that time, you know, before the tension starts to build again, there is like hope and love that gets created that carries sometimes women or the abused person through to the next phase, which goes around again. So
it's one of the things that we see as well in child exploitation in terms of survival sex, where the pimp starts off where it's almost like a boyfriend-girlfriend type of relationship, and gives them presents, tells them they love them, they're beautiful, all that, and really builds up their self-esteem when sometimes they're at a very vulnerable state because they're quite young. And it's a very similar cycle as well. And as well as that, when we were at the Building Bridges, a couple of the workers from BC Women's were mentioning in the maternity wards, in some of them, that they see it where the father of the child is at the bedside, really great bedside manner, until they leave the room, and then they overhear them sometimes, and it's quite horrific how they treat the women.
And that's part of how the perpetrator sets up a certain relationship or situation that, the outside person might say, oh, you know, like in our exercise that we talked about, the family, she goes to the family, and they're like, oh, he's a pretty good guy, you know, we think he's great or whatever, and you've just got hormonal issues, or maybe you're overreacting or things like that. I hear that constantly from people trying to rationalize, or from the outside, thinking that things are a certain way because the abuser has created a certain behavior pattern that makes him or her look really good. So there's these phases. There's the setup, the abuse, the guilt and the fear of reprisal, the rationalization, the normal behavior, fantasy and planning, and then the setup again, the abuse again. So I'm just going to quickly go over those just for people that are looking for warning behaviors that they might see in their relationship or in other people's behaviors where they might be triggered to understand this cycle of violence and abuse in a relationship. So,
and one of the things I did want to point out, Julia and I talked about this before the show, about the little exercise that we led you through, the fact that that woman had been with her husband for 7 years, and she there wasn't any abuse until after the child was born in terms of physical.
Well, there wasn't
there was
physical,
emotional
but there was,
and that type of abuse where he slowly pushed her friends and family away.
Yeah. Pushing your friends and family away. And
so it's not necessarily you'll see it immediately. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's gradual over time. Mm-hmm. So just being really, really aware.
So in this cycle, there's the setup where the abuser kind of creates and controls situations, like in that example that Caroline just said, in which the victim sort of has no choice but to react in a way that will, in the abuser's mind, justify the abuse. So setting them up to be really aggravated, and in the mind of the abuser, they're thinking that the person deserves it. So in the mind of the abuser, when the time and planned circumstances are right, the abuser perpetrates the violence. The attack is a display of power and control over the victim and over everyone else in the household. And over time, often this abuse part of the cycle worsens. It's quite common for it to get worse.
And guilt and fear of reprisal. After abuse, the abuser may have feelings of guilt. And it's not normal guilt. It's as in feeling sorry for hurting another person, but it's more of an expression of fear of getting caught and being accountable for the abuse. The abuser may apologize. It flips back into what Julia was calling the honeymoon period. They may make excuses for abusive behavior and pledge never to do it again, sometimes using gifts and promises and bribes as a way of just trying to get rid of that guilt and fear. And the real purpose is basically to silence the victim and prevent the victim from ever speaking out.
Mm-hmm. And again, that rationalization that happens in the abuser's mind. I mean, they state that it's the victim's fault. The abuser makes justifications. The victim has made the abuser mad. It's the victim's fault. This provides a justification for the abusive behavior, and it's used as permission to continue abuse in the future. The abuser denies and ignores his personal responsibility for the abuse, and this is often the rationalization cycle that you'll see where the abuser, the abused person doesn't really get, like, they think it's their fault, and this kind of activity goes mm-hmm. on. So,
and there's normal behavior between the incidences of abuse. The abuser often acts as if nothing happened, and so the victim starts to participate in the cover-up. The abuser threatens the victim's credibility by saying things like, nobody will believe you. And they make subtle and indirect threats, as if you say anything, you're never going to see your child again. Very similar to in terms of when that woman in that exercise wanted to go for help, and she didn't want to get the psychiatric evaluation because she was afraid that would be used against her.
That's right, yeah. So in the normal behavior, again, as part of, it could be a short time, could be a longer time. But again, the abuser, in the mind of the abuser, they start to fantasize and plan again for returning to that cycle again around setting up for creating and controlling situations so that in their mind they justify the abuse, and they do this by sort of fantasizing and planning about past or future abuses, which feeds their anger and then propels them to begin actively planning their next abuse. So the abuser may plan a future attack using excuses from the rationalization stage, and also begins to set the victim up, meaning, you know, aggravating them to react and to argue or whatever else might happen, where in the abuser's mind justifying the abuse. So these are some of the warning behaviors. If you see any of this sort of happening in your relationship on a minor scale, you know, it may take years before it escalates into something a little larger, but just as a warning signs that this is the kind of behavior that can happen in abusive relationships. It can take a very different, I think it can look very different from the outside and from the inside and from relationship to relationship. There's this often about power and control, and this is the main, I'm just looking, Caroline, can you talk for one sec? Because I have to look for something.
In terms of with power and control.
Yeah, and just domination. And some of what we were learning at the Building Bridges thing. I'm just looking for the paperwork that we had from that. I want to quote it properly, but
there was a lot of interesting things there. One of the key things was, I like the fact that they're pulling it together in terms of trying to get all the service providers to start working together. As you could see from that exercise, things like mental ill health, addiction, all of that fed into something that they don't use the term domestic violence anymore. They use relationship.
And woman abuse.
Yeah. In terms of that.
But there's so much. I mean, I think it's like, the statistics are like 85%, you know, it's women or more mm-hmm. in relationships that are being abused. So it's a very big majority. Again, because abuse is so much about power, control, and domination, you know, males are the stronger sex. And so oftentimes it is really down to that kind of simplistic exchange of power, or not exchange of power, but of domination of power.
Demonstration of power.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
We have some. We want to support people that are listening into the show tonight, so some resources to go to for more help and for more information, and so we'll make sure that we
we'll put that up on the website afterwards.
And we'll mention there's a lot of support out there. I know that when we did our exercise at the top of the hour, it was sounding pretty bleak and horrible out there, but there's definitely ways to get the system to work for you. And you're welcome to email Julia at Juicebox Radio as well if you need some more information about that. So we're going to take a short break, and we're going to return at the second half of the show and begin to talk a little bit about how sexual and relationship violence, being about power and control, and interestingly enough, so is BDSM. So again, the controversy that we wanted to bring up tonight around bondage discipline, sadism, masochism, the BDSM scene that's quite popular and growing in the city and growing in many parts of the world, huge online, etc., again, about power and control. So we're going to talk about the links and the differences between these lifestyles and behaviors. So make sure you stay tuned, and we'll be back. You can give us a call if you want on this short break, 604-822-2487. You are in Juicebox, featured on Vancouver's CITR. That's 101.9 FM in Vancouver. I will be right back.
Behind it's fine all of the time, like sex on the beaches. What else is in the teachers of peaches? Huh, what? Sucking on my titties like you wanted me, calling me all the time, that Bondi. Check out my Chrissy behind it's fine all of the time. What else is in the teachers of peaches? Like sex on the beaches,
Juicebox is a sexuality education show geared to adult audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
And we are back in the box. And if you're tuning in and Julia is typing and...
You said that somebody had written us a message?
Yes.
Do you want to read that one?
Definitely. If you're tuning in right now, we've been talking about sexual violence, and we are about to talk about BDSM. And just on my Twitter feed, I had somebody just reminding us in regards to about men, and that men do get abused as well. And sometimes it's very difficult for them to leave because there's a lot of shame and stigma attached to that.
About them being weak because they've been abused by women and they're too weak to or that they, what's the embarrassment? Because they say, no, it's just a short little thing there.
Oh, I'll tell you in just one moment. Just don't forget about the men. Men are abused, and it's harder for men to leave. I think there's more shame.
All right, so let's talk about that under the context of what the Building Bridges workshop through BC Women's Hospital we went to a few weeks ago. Caroline, there was a whole sheet here on very recent...
About men.
Research about what about abused men. So there's this myth of mutual battering that goes on, and those working in the anti-violence, substance use, or mental health fields will likely have encountered situations where relationship violence may be difficult to judge who's the abuser or the primary aggressor really is. And when discussing abuse, it's still common to hear people speak about mutual abuse or to use a phrase such as, it takes two to tango. And although men in same-sex and heterosexual relationships can experience abuse, the prevalence and the severity of violence against women requires that we focus on the gendered nature of violence and abuse. And I quoted earlier in the show that there was 85% of victims of abuse are women. It's actually 88 to 95% in the research. And this is like 2005 statistics from across multidisciplinary research. 88 to 95% are women. So, yes, men are abused, but it's not nearly the problem. That is not even close. It's 5% to 7% of people that are abused are men. So, you know, we just want to make sure that we're not doing the takes two to tango and the mutual battering, and that it's women who start it. Because honestly, when the context of abuse is included, it's evident that women actually rarely initiate violence against men. Women's aggression is mostly retaliatory or self-defense, and that the violence experienced by women as well as its impacts is actually more severe than that is experienced by men. Because you have to also understand that we're speaking about violence. If you're talking about emotional, mental, verbal abuse, perhaps it can go both ways, quite mutually. I don't know enough about the research about that. But when we're talking about aggressive, violent, sexual, those kind of acts, it certainly is the men that are doing the devastating effects.
And on that note, according to the Elizabeth Fry Society, which helps women who are getting out of prison, 90% of the women who end up in correctional facilities have dealt with sexual violence before the age of 18. 90%.
Right. So really, mutual battering is a myth. It's also inaccurate to state that women are never violent. Women can be violent, absolutely.
Definitely.
Abuse is about social, economic, and physical power, which is usually unequally distributed based on gender. And generally, it's the women that have the short end of that stick. So just to keep in mind, yes, women can be violent, and yes, we can be abusers. But we're talking 88% to 95% of victims of abuse are women. So, men, there is support out there for you as well. And, of course, absolutely shouldn't be feeling the shame of doing something about that.
No, no one who's a victim should.
Mm-hmm. Again, you know, sexual and relationship violence is about power and control. And we had said earlier before we went into the break that, interestingly enough, so is BDSM. And I often, when we have people talking to us on the show about BDSM, we've had many, many shows over the years about this topic. you know, I don't want to bring up history of abuse and why people like BDSM. So tonight we don't have a guest talking about BDSM. So I get to speak quite openly about my opinion about it, and Caroline will as well of hers. But at first, a big difference between BDSM and sexual and relationship violence in the state that we were talking about in the first half is that these outcomes of the relationship are consensual. So, you know, often with abuse and violence that's not consensual, that's what we were sort of speaking about earlier. But there's a big difference about this power and control is that it's usually quite consensual and set up in a certain way that's very distinctive and spoken about and understood.
I agree. One of the things we should probably touch on, which we mentioned in the first half, is what is BDSM to start with? And it is an acronym for bondage, discipline, dominance, and submission. So sadism,
also for sadism and masochism. Yeah. I mean, the B, the D, the S, and the M stand for either, you know, discipline or dominance, bondage, you know, submission or sadism. So it's all kind of intermingled in there.
Mm-hmm.
But BDSM is sort of the acronym that we go for. And it's includes a wide spectrum of activities and sort of forms of interpersonal relationships.
Mm-hmm.
Not always overtly sexual in nature. The activities and relationships within a BDSM context are almost always eroticized by the participants in some fashion. So they might not be doing sexual things necessarily. It might be just a spanking thing, or you get tied up and spanked, but people eroticize what's going on. So it's often wrapped up into a sexual thing. For other people, this is a lifestyle. We'll talk about this. Many of these practices do fall outside of commonly held social norms regarding sexuality and relationships. And so they are BDSM practitioners and people that are in this lifestyle are seen as, what's the word, I guess,
out of the norm?
Well,
out of mainstream?
Yeah, I also want to go a little deeper with it and consider it to be something like
abnormal sexual behavior?
No. But deviant, I guess, is a kind of a good way to describe, I think, BDSM. Because
I think it's a very good way. That's why there's like Sin City, where it's...
Yeah, it's going against the grain.
Creating the safe space or the dungeon.
But you're also deviant. And I think I like that word because I think people in BDSM scenes do use it.
They do. And it can be a sexy word.
Mm-hmm.
In the right circumstance.
So some of the activities under the umbrella of BDSM are not limited to, but do include things like dominance and submission and discipline and punishment, bondage, sexual role-playing, sexual fetishism, paraphilias oftentimes being displayed out, sadomasochism, and always, always, always about power exchange.
Definitely.
So an important distinction that BDSM practitioners do speak about is that this is not a form of sexual abuse. And although some BDSM activities may appear to be violent or coercive, such activities are conducted with the consent of all partners involved. And BDSM relationships and practices are exercised under the philosophy of safe, sane, and consensual, or somewhat more permissive philosophy of risk-aware, consensual kink.
I like that.
Mm-hmm. RAC, they call it. So activities and relationships within this BDSM context are characterized by the fact that the participants usually take on this complementary but unequal roles. So again, dominance and submission, I think that happens in a lot of healthy sexual relationships. I don't think there's anything really that's unusual. I think a lot of us have a dominant trait, a submissive trait inside of our sexual beings. But I'm thinking more on the sadism, masochism side of the BDSM practitioner, the pain, the blood play, the whole thing around that. So, you know, why do people like to get spanked? What is it about pain and pleasure that are so closely linked?
Well, when I sent out the show teaser to our fan club, we got some interesting responses. And actually, here's one of the letters we got from one of our regular listeners. Well, as a despiser of any kind of violence against women, and as a former participant in some light BDSM, I can say it was extremely difficult for me at first to get past the never hit girls rule. And that's been drilled into most boys from the time we've been able to understand language and can actually hit a girl who wanted to play. I did manage to get over it based almost solely on the fact that I could see how pleasurable it was for my partner. Although I understand that the pleasure-pain line is a fine one indeed, I've also heard from others that some men, and women too, who are more into it, take the hardcore type of BDSM play, are truly sadists at heart, and do take pleasure from hurting others in a consensual way, of course. Given the intricate worlds involved in BDSM play, I think most people who are involved with it manage to stay within the predetermined hard limit. But that said, I'm sure there's some people who get involved who do have violent issues. Of course, the same could be said for any contact sport, road rage, bullying, etc. So I thought it was interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it did give us cause for writing, the next little bits that we did in the script tonight and to discuss. And
like, why? Mm-hmm. Like, why do some people like it? Like, what is it? And it actually has to do with...
Why do they like to be slapped and smacked and spanked and have pain? And, yeah.
Well, it makes them feel good. Apparently, there's that fine line between pleasure and pain, and BDSM practitioners often compare the effects induced by the endorphins, very similar to a runner's high or an afterglow of an orgasm, and there's a corresponding, as they describe it, a trance-like mental state known as subspace, and it's regularly described as it's really comfortable and
comforting.
It was actually pretty comforting, soothing.
Yeah, well, I think that, and Caroline and I looked a little deeper into this, and we looked up at some brain science research, and mm-hmm. that the regions of the brain that manage sexual stimuli and that manage pain actually overlap, and they're in the same neurological pathways often. So it results in some individuals associating pain with sexual pleasure because these neurological reactions are kind of intertwined. So why are some people wired for sexual sadism and masochism? I mean, it's really interesting. It's usually, agreed upon by psychologists that experiences during early sexual development and what kind of experiences exactly those, are in what we're going to talk about. And these experiences can have a profound effect on the character of your sexuality later in life. And, if you have sadomasochistic desires, they can form in early age, but they can also form in a variety of ages. So some individuals report having had them before puberty, while others do not discover them until well into adulthood. So again, is this personality, where is nature and nurture begin and end? Often a lot of the research says that the majority of male sadomasochists, 53% of them, develop their interest before the age of 15, while the majority of female sadomasochists, 78% of them, develop their interest after. So this is a bit of older research, but, like sexual fetishes, sadomasochism can be learned through conditioning. And in this context, I think that the repeated association of sexual pleasure with an object or a stimulus of, say, abuse, violence, pain, that kind of thing, begins to create a pattern and a conditioning in yourself that you then consider sex to be the trauma of your past then becomes sexualized into your present BDSM behavior.
Definitely.
And this is part of what I think that a lot of the BDSM guests we have had on don't want to really look at, and they don't wish to really consider, is that there is a tie that binds often between sexual addiction, between BDSM behavior, and sort of this past trauma and past abuse. So, even in some of the newer research that I've looked into, 2002, down in the States, female addicted trauma survivors, they basically present this wide array of variant and perverse behaviors in sexuality, often leading to a BDSM behavior and lifestyle. So, again, these are some of the things that I've thought about for years. I have been kind of deeply disturbed by what I have found in the research. And then I've had this radio show that has been celebrating sexual diversity and have had many BDSM people come on and making it all kind of kinky and fun. And there's always been this part of me that's like, well, you know, something seems a little bit divergent from what's healthy. And what is it so much about power and control and addiction and sort of life trauma or sexual traumas that now are being reenacted in the BDSM sexual environment? There's always this darkness, that the dark energy that comes with the BDSM. You know, you go to any of these play parties that mm-hmm. you were talking about, people dressing up in their black leather and their black plastic, you know,
PVC.
Exactly, and sort of, you know, tying themselves up and beating themselves or, you know, others. And I have to admit, I've also done some of it in my past, you know, being in these sort of situations, all under the name of research, of course. And, you know, people really get off on this kind of behavior and activities. And I've asked, you know, many, many people over the years, many, many guests and different conference goers or fetish, you know, people at these different fetish parties. And I've said, you know,
why?
What do you think about the connection between perhaps life trauma, survival of sexual abuse, of violence in your past, and what you've then sexualized and are now reenacting in the BDSM environment or in lifestyle. And, you know, when I've had an honest response, I think people have said that, you know, early on in their lives, they had this experience or that experience, and it was very inappropriate or very too early on in their sexual, you know, or their lives growing up. So really, I think the sexual addiction part of it, the compulsivity that comes, you know, is again a brain, you know, mapping that can be remapped. So a lot of times, if you, like any other addiction or any other kind of state-dependent sort of treatment recommendations that are made to you, if you have these kind of behaviors or feeling, you know, struggling with it, mm-hmm. There is help. And I'm not trying to say that BDSM practitioners are all sick and they need to look at this stuff, but if it is something that is connecting with your, as you hear what I'm saying, that perhaps there is a connection for you that you can access some of the resources that Caroline and I obtained through this Building Bridges workshop, and I think some really helpful next steps on getting the help that you may need or want, and exploring sort of a return to a healthy and functional state for yourself and your life.
And there's a great book called Who's Been Sleeping in My Head as well, where it's a psychologist who actually goes through and interviews hundreds of patients about their sexual fantasies. And a lot of them are BDSM related, and a lot of them are connected with abuse and different things that happened in childhood. So there's a lot too. So if you're not comfortable seeking help right away, or you just want to find out more about it, or you're even curious, why do you have fantasies about certain things? Mm-hmm. It's great to check in there, and you can kind of look up your fantasy. It's really neat. There's a whole index in the back. It's quite fascinating, actually.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm not saying that, again, dominance and submission is anything unhealthy. In fact, I think it's quite normal for us to have, you know, fantasies of dominance and submission. I'm speaking a little bit more, I think, tonight about this sadomasochism, the sadistic, masochistic behaviors that are pain involved and trauma involved. And, I mean, you know, breaking of bones and blood play and sort of maybe a little bit more of, like, getting off on really the pain that you're causing other people or being caused to yourself through the consensual activity of BDSM. Just looking a little deeper into that, and I've wanted to explore this for a while. So there are actually, as Caroline pointed out in the research here, I found was really helpful, was that there are a minority of BDSM practitioners who do take part in BDSM for... they do not receive any personal gratification whatsoever. They actually enter these situations solely with the intention to allow their partners to fulfill their own needs and or fetishes. And so they really get nothing much out of it, but know that it's pleasing their partners. So there are a minority of BDSM people involved in that, just to make sure that they're also mentioned. So I think... again, Caroline and I will put up some of the online resources that are available for, linking sort of women abuse, substance use, mental ill health, and that kind of thing, and this different health frameworks and toolkits and et cetera, and places to go. So,
and the exciting thing, I wanted to tie in the whole thing in regards to the Building Bridges conference that we went to. They are doing more and more work just to try and bridge the gap between per service providers, between mental people dealing with mental ill health, violence in their relationships. They're trying to flee from that, as well as mental ill health and addiction. And I think I said that already, didn't I? But in regards to that, just bridging that gap so it's not so traumatic where somebody is trying to get into one service provider to another where they're trying to work together.
Right.
And I think the Building Bridges program is a really, really wonderful one. And
helps.
I was really honored, Julia, that you brought me to it.
Oh,
I was quite
excited.
And brought a little bit of that back to Beauty Night. So that was quite exciting, too. So it's being able to bring all the worlds around full circle.
Right on. Yeah, I was glad to have you there. You were certainly much more linked into it than I was, and I have been in my professional world. But on the BDSM front, just because we didn't really finish up what we wanted to sort of do tonight, that was around sort of the paraphilia and around safety and when people freak out and have, like, they kind of go into some kind of mental or emotional break.
Aftercare. How do you take care of somebody? How do you set up with consent? Because we talked a little bit about consent, but how do you set that up at the beginning? How do you find out what's okay? All those things. So I think we're going to be leaving you with a little bit of a cliffhanger. So next week you're going to have to listen in and find out about all that stuff. And we'll get into a little bit more of the paraphernalias and all that stuff too.
Paraphernalias. And I'm sure if we have any of our listeners that are BDSM practitioners and or would like to offer their
opinion.
Take on it or opinion on what we've talked about tonight and or please
write into
us at julia@juiceboxradio.com or to caroline@juiceboxradio.com. And we hope you learned something from tonight's show. I don't know about enjoying it so much, but certainly learning. And Caroline and I will be back next week to follow up this chilling or exciting, depending on how you experience it, aspect of the darker side of sexuality and relationships. So stay tuned for Hans Claus's Misery Hour with Hans Claus.
Von Claus.
Von Claus. Hans Von Claus. Sorry, it's an old script ending there. I forgot to put in the Von Claus. I love that.
He is my hero.
He is our shoe hero.
He is my hero. He is my shoe hero, and he actually brought my purse and my laptop that I left here last week because I was really tired.
Oh.
I think I got too happy about the sexual health thing that from last week when we had Laska on with Sex Ed with a Twist. So we're talking about old sex toys. So I found it very fascinating, actually. It was very interesting.
And because you were so excited, you left all your shit behind.
Exactly.
Okay, great. Well, our lovely Hans von Claus, he saved the day, and he brought your shit back to you, my love. So
I know. He's
good.
My hero.
He's a very sexy man to be miserable with.
Very.
So,
I'll be remembered for that.
What was that?
What?
I'll be remembered by bringing bags and laptops to people.
That's what you'll be remembered for. That's
aww.
Right, darling. And the fact that I think someone's got a birthday coming up. He's like, how do you know? Because
you.
I snuck the information and found out.
Happy birthday.
I think it's next Tuesday.
To you.
Monday.
Happy birthday,
dear
Hans von Claus.
Happy birthday
to you. And on that night week, we will be back next week at 10 o'clock.
A cock. What was I thinking?
I don't know.
10 o'clock. Cock. All right. Ouch.
Munch.
You just experienced Juicebox Radio, a show dedicated to developing your relational and individual